So before we actually start our talk, we do want to kind of get us into the mood of this commemorative meeting for Mr. Judge. And we know that he did a lot of writing in regards to meditation, which is such an important part of our philosophy. So I'll just read this short little quote by him. Arouse, arouse in you the beginning of thou art that. Thou art the self. This is the thing to think of in meditation. And if you believe it, then tell others the same. You have read it before, but now try to realize it more and more each day, and you will have the light you want. And that's very appropriate because we're looking at Mr. Judge as philosopher, guide, and friend today. Mr. Judge passed March 21st, 1896, and we will be looking at his life and his work in the light of theosophy. We will try to understand the idea of the cyclical nature and reincarnation of this form that we know as William Quan Judge. But we know that he's only part of a group of great souls whose only focus was to pass on this knowledge. The meeting will be broken up into three different parts. The first one will be a biographical sketch of his life, of his writings. We will then have four short talks that are appropriate for Mr. Judge. And then we will have a longer talk regarding his contribution to the philosophy. One of the things we need to look at when we're looking at Mr. Judge's life is the time period in which he was born and which time he grew to manhood. It was the rise of industrialism, the rise of materialism, and a time when people were looking more on outside than rather inside of their souls. And the Civil War was ending or was over, which we think had something to do with the rise of spiritualism, because so many of our soldiers died during that war, and people were desperate to try and contact them. So Mr. Judge was born in Ireland, April 13th, 1851. His mother's name was Alice Mary Quan, and his father was Frederick Judge. And his father, it's interesting, was a practicing Mason. But unfortunately, he did not have much contact with his mother because she died when he was very young. Mr. Judge Sr. took the family and moved to New York City when young William was only 13. And that was around the time that the Great Famine, the potato famine in Ireland, was going on. So young Mr. Judge ends up in New York City, and we really do not know a whole lot about a lot of details about his childhood. One major thing we do know is that when he was around 7 years old, his physical form died. It was a very serious illness that he had. And the family felt as though, they were starting to think about getting him ready for burial, that whole thing, when all of a sudden he revives. But this is not the same William Jr. that woke up from the one that died. There were a lot of new tendencies that he had. One of them was that he did not, before he died, he did not know how to read. And after he revives, not only can he read, but he is reading some books on the Book of Revelations, Rosicrucianism, magic, religion, mesmerism. He studied phrenology. So this young man really was, you know, a changed person when he was revived. But he never regained himself physically. But spiritually, he was quite profound. And he was a very persistent and dedicated young man. There's the story that we hear in the philosophy about when he was young. He didn't know how to swim, and his friends were taunting him, and they wanted to cross this river. And they all swam across and were taunting him that, oh, you're not going to be able to do it. But what he did was he swam, he sank, walked across the bottom of the river, bobbed up, grabbed some air, went down, and he did this all the way across until he did make it to the other side. So that is just an example of his persistence and his ingenuity. As a young man, he started working as a clerk in a law office, and he worked there long enough, and then eventually he did become a lawyer, and he specialized in commercial law. And he was known for his thoroughness, his persistence, and his industry, and his honesty. He was naturalized as an American citizen in April of 1872. In 1874, he married Ella Smith of Brooklyn. They had one child who unfortunately passed away at a very young age, and this is said to have affected Mr. Judge very profoundly because he loved children, and they were very much attracted to him. Whenever he showed up, you know, they would run to him, and one, they said he loved to sit on his lap. Soon after they were married, Mr. Judge read Colonel Henry Alcott's book on spiritualism and was profoundly affected by this. He contacted Mr. Alcott and requested to be introduced to HPB. And that was a major reunion of sorts. And there's this wonderful quote by him, by Mr. Judge. "It was her eye that attracted me, the eye of one whom I must have known in lives long passed away. She looked at me in recognition at that first hour, and never since has that look changed. Not as a questioner of philosophies did I come before her, not as one groping in the dark for lights that schools and fanciful theories had obscured, but as one who, wandering many periods through the corridors of life, was seeking the friends who could show where the designs for the work had been hidden. And true to the call, she responded, revealing the plans once again, and speaking no words to explain, simply pointed them out and went on with the task. It was as if the evening before we had parted, leaving yet to be done some detail of a task taken up with one common end. It was teacher and pupil, elder brother and younger, both bent on the one single end, but she with the power and the knowledge that belonged to the lions and sages. So, friends, from the first, I felt safe." So this friendship that the two of them had was obviously not one that was just started in this lifetime, but was brought forward from previous lives. So he stayed in New York while she was there studying with her and helping her with working on Isis Unveiled. Along with Colonel Alcott, the three of them, back in September of 75, looked at the possibility of starting the Theosophical movement. And then on November 7th of 1875, the Theosophical Society in the United States was started. Around this time, Mr. Judge went to South America, and that's where he contracted Chagas fever, which will have affected him his entire life, and eventually he did succumb to that. In 1878, HPB and Colonel Olcott went to India, and Mr. Judge, at the tender young age of only 27, stayed in the United States, and his job was to try and spread broadcast the teachings. In 1884, he did go to Europe with HPB, but when he returned this time, he was re-energized to really push forward and get the philosophy spread broadcast even more than what it was. So as he started traveling to put forth these ideas, his reputation, his perseverance, and his dedication helped to increase the numbers of the Theosophical Society. It is said that he was considered to be a disciple under trial. HPB says of him, his ego had reincarnated several times immediately after death in order to further this work. And he established the American section with all branches being independent in 1885. Unfortunately, after HPB died in 1891, the interest in the Theosophical Society began to decrease. But even though all this was going on, and there is quite a history behind it, he is known as the resuscitator of Theosophy in America. He lectured, and we know that he was an avid writer. We are so lucky to have all of his writings available in print to us. All this while, he was still working as a lawyer. But eventually, the work got so voluminous that he did have to leave his profession, because his entire focus, his entire life, was for the philosophy. And it is said that he would sometimes, when the numbers began to drop, he would still honor the cycle of the meetings by coming to the meeting halls and having a meeting, even if it was just going to be him. In 1886, his magazine, The Path, was started. And it is said that his qualities of being organized, practical, mystical, and devotional, were all because he was so loyal to the masters and to HPB and to the philosophy. As we said, his only aim was to further the cause of theosophy, and to this was his only dedication. So not only The Path, but we know that he wrote The Ocean of Theosophy. We are so lucky to have his letters that have helped many people. It's the kind of book in letters that have helped me, like you just open it up, and whatever it drops open to, there's something in those letters that can help anybody with whatever issue they have. And it's interesting, we were talking about this recently, that what are we missing by the computers? You know, we don't have these letters that people are holding on to, but at least we have Mr. Judge's letters to refer to. He wrote Echoes of the Orient, The Epitome of Theosophy, the Gita translation, and the 7 first chapters of the Gita notes, Patanjali's Yoga Aphorisms, and of course, his voluminous articles. So Mr. Judge died, as we said, March 21st, 1896. And this is his last message. There should be calmness, hold fast, and go slow. If you take down those words and remember them, you will find that they contain an epitome of his whole life struggle. He believed in theosophy and lived it. He believed because he knew that the great self of which he has so often spoke was the eternal self, was himself.
The first reading selected for today is from the writings of H.P. Blavatsky. Theosophy is as old as the world in its teachings and ethics, if not in name. Underlying every ancient popular religion was the same ancient wisdom doctrine, one and identical, professed and practiced by the initiates of every country, who alone were aware of its existence and importance. To ascertain its origin and the precise age in which it was matured is now beyond human possibility. A philosophy so profound, a moral code so ennobling, and practical results so conclusive and so uniformly demonstrable is not the growth of a generation or even a single epoch. Fact must have been piled upon fact, deduction upon deduction. Science have begotten science, and the myriads of the brightest human intellects have reflected upon the laws of nature before this ancient doctrine had taken concrete shape. The wisdom religion is the inheritance of all the nations, the world over. The aims of theosophy are several, but the most important of all are those which are likely to lead to the relief of human suffering under any or every form, moral as well as physical. And we believe the former to be far more important than the latter. Theosophy has to inculcate ethics. It has to purify the soul if it would relieve the physical body, whose ailments, save cases of accidents, are all hereditary. It is not by studying occultism for selfish ends that one can ever reach the true goal, that of helping suffering mankind. As mankind is essentially of one and the same essence, and that essence is one, infinite, uncreate, and eternal, whether we call it God or nature. Nothing, therefore, can affect one nation or one man without affecting all other nations and all other men. This is as certain and as obvious as that a stone thrown into a pond will, sooner or later, set in motion every single drop of water therein. It is an occult law that no man can rise superior to his individual failings without lifting, be it ever so little, the whole body of which he is an integral part. In the same way, no one can sin nor suffer the effect of sin alone. All pain and suffering are results of want of harmony, and the one terrible and only cause of the disturbance of harmony is selfishness in some form or another. Hence, karma given back to every man the actual consequences of his own actions without any regard to their moral character. But since he receives his due for all, it is obvious that he will be made to atone for all sufferings which he has caused, just as he will reap in joy and gladness the fruits of all the happiness and harmony he had helped to produce. Make men feel and recognize in their innermost hearts what is their real, true duty to all men, and every old abuse of power, every iniquitous law in the national policy based on human, social, or political selfishness will disappear of itself.
Second reading are excerpts from the Gita notes. All of us are brought to this study by our own request, made to our higher self, who is Krishna. It does not matter whether now he is consciously aware of having made the request, nor whether it was made as a specific act in this life or in another precedent one. It was made and it is to be answered at the right time. Some of us have asked this many times before in ancient births of ours, in other bodies and other lands. Others are making the request now, but it is more than likely in the case of those who are spurred on to intense effort and longing to know the truth and to strive for unity with God that they have put up the petition ages since. We take up the gauge over and over, life after life, in experience after experience, never completely defeated if we always look to Krishna, our higher self. All the passing shows of life, whether fraught with disaster or full of fame and glory, are teachers. He who neglects them neglects opportunities which seldom the gods repeat. And the only way to learn from them is through the heart's resignation. For when we become in heart completely poor, we are at once the treasurers and dispersers of enormous riches. The attitude to be assumed, then, is that of doing every act, small or great, trifling or important, because it is before us to do, and as a mere carrying out by us as instruments of the will of that deity who is ourselves. This practice is the highest, that which someday we must and will learn to perform. Effacement in the Supreme Spirit is gained by the right seeing. whose sins are exhausted, who hath cut asunder all doubts, whose senses and organs are under control, and who is devoted to the well-being of all creatures. If the last qualification is absent, then he is not a right-seeing sage and cannot reach union with the Supreme. It must follow that the humblest imitator, every one who desires to come to that condition, must try to the best of his ability to imitate the sage who has succeeded. And such is the word of the Master, for he says in many places that if we expect to have his help, we must apply ourselves to the work of helping humanity to the extent of our ability. No more than this is demanded. Krishna says that those who, with the eye of spiritual wisdom, see that the self is all, begin to reincarnate with that belief ingrained in them. Hitherto, they come back to earth without that single idea, but possessed of many desires and of ideas which separated them from the self. Now they begin to return fully at rest in the self and working out their long accumulated karma. And at last they become a Mahatma or great soul.
From the writings of William Q. Judge. Some years ago, one of those masters in whom so many of our members believe directed HPB to write a letter for him to a certain body of theosophists. In this he said that each member could become, in his own town or city, if earnest, sincere and unselfish, an active center from which would radiate unseen powerful forces able to influence men and women in the vicinity for good, and that soon inquirers would appear, a branch in time be organized, and thus the whole neighborhood would receive benefit. This seems just and reasonable in addition to its being stated by such high authority. Members ought to consider and think over it so that action may follow. Too many who think themselves theosophically alone in their own town have folded their hands and shut up their minds, saying to themselves that they could do nothing, that no one was near who could possibly care for theosophy, and that particular town was the most difficult for the work. The great mistake in these cases is forgetting the law indicated in what HPB wrote. It is one that every member ought to know, that the mind of man is capable of bringing about results through means of other minds about him. If we sit and think that nothing can be done, then our subtle mind meets other minds within the radius of our sphere, not small, and shout unto them, nothing can be done. Of course, then nothing is done. But if unselfishly and earnestly we think theosophy and desire that others should, like us, be benefited by it, then to the minds we meet in stray moments of the day and in many hours of the night, we cry theosophy and help and hope for thee. The result must be an awakening of interest upon the slightest provocative occasion, such as inner attitude added to every sort of attempt at promulgation, will disclose many unsuspected persons who are thinking along this very line. Thus will the opportunity of the hour be taken advantage of. The masters have said this is a transition age, and he who has ears to hear will hear what has thus been said. We're working for the new cycles and centuries. What we do now in this transition age will be like what the great Dion Choans did in the transition point, the midway point in evolution. At the time when all matter and all types were in a transition and fluid state. They then gave the new impulse for the new types, which resulted later in all the vast varieties of nature. In mental development, we are now at the same point, and what we now do in faith and hope for others and for ourselves will result similarly on the plane to which it is all directed. Thus, in other centuries, we will come out again and go on with it. If we neglect it now, so much the worse for us dead. Hence, we are not working for some definite organization of the new years to come, but for a change in the manners and booty of the race. That is why it may seem indefinite, but it is nevertheless very defined and very great in scope.
Musings on the True Theosophist Path. The way of inward peace is in all things to conform to the pleasure and disposition of the divine will, such as would have all things succeed and come to pass according to their own fancy are not come to know this way, and therefore lead a harsh and bitter life, always restless and out of humor, without treading the way of peace. Know then, O man, that he who seeks the hidden way can only find it through the door of life. In the hearts of all, at some time, there arises the desire for knowledge. He who thinks his desire will be fulfilled as the little bird in the nest, who has only to open his mouth to be fed, will very truly be disappointed. In all nature, we can find no instance where effort of some kind is not required. We find there is a natural result from such effort. He who would live the life or find wisdom can only do so by continued effort. If one becomes a student and learns to look partially within the veil, or has found within his own being something that is greater than his outer self, it gives no authority for one to sit down in idleness or fence himself in from contact with the world. Because one sees the gleam of light ahead, he cannot say to his fellow, "I am holier than thou," or draw the mantle of seclusion around himself. The soul develops like the flower in God's sunlight and unconsciously to the soil in which it grows. Shut out the light and the soil grows damp and sterile. The flower withers or grows pale and sickly. Each and every one is here for a good and wise reason. If we find partially the why we are here, then is there the more reason that we should, by intelligent contact with life, seek in it the further elucidation of the problem. It is not the study of ourselves so much as the thought for others that opens this door. The events of life and their causes lead to knowledge.
They must be studied when they are manifested in daily life. There is no idleness for the mystic. He finds his daily life among the roughest and hardest of the labors and trials of the world, perhaps, but goes his way with smiling face and joyful heart, nor grows too sensitive for association with his fellows, nor so extremely spiritual as to forget that some other body is perhaps hungering for food. It is said by one who pretended to teach the mysteries, "It is needful that I have a pleasant location and beautiful surroundings." He who is a true theosophist will wait for nothing of the sort, either before teaching or what is first needful, learning. It would perhaps be agreeable, but if the divine inspiration comes only under those conditions, then indeed is the divine afar from most of us. He only can be a factor for good or teach how to approach the way who, forgetting his own surroundings, strives to beautify and illumine those of others. The effort must be for the good of others, not the gratifying of our own senses or love for the agreeable or pleasant. Giving thought to self will most truly prevent and overthrow your aims and objects, particularly when directed toward the occult. Again, there arises the thought, I am a student, a holder of a portion of the mystic lore. Insidiously, there steals in the thought, behold, I'm a little more than other men who have not penetrated so far. Know then, O man, that you are not as great even as they. He who thinks he is wise is the most ignorant of men, and he who begins to believe he is wise is in greater danger than any other man who lives. You think, O man, that because you have obtained a portion of occult knowledge, that it entitles you to withdraw from contact with the rest of mankind? It is not so. If you have obtained true knowledge, it forces you to meet all men not only halfway, but more than to seek them out. It urges you not to retire, but seeking contact, to plunge into the misery and sorrow of the world. And with your cheering word, if you have no more, the mystic has little else, strive to lighten the burden for some struggling soul. You dream of fame. We know no such thing as fame. He who seeks the upward path finds that all is truth, that evil is the good gone astray. Why should we ask for fame? It is only the commendation of those we strive to help. Desire neither notice, fame, nor wealth. Unknown, you are in retirement. Being fameless, you are undisturbed in your seclusion and can walk the broad face of the earth, fulfilling your duty as commanded, unrecognized. If the duty grows hard or you faint by the way, be not discouraged, fearful, or weary of the world. Remember that thou mayest look for silence in tumult, solitude in company, light in darkness, forgetfulness in pressures, vigor in despondency, courage in fear, resistance in temptation, peace in war, and quiet in tribulation.
Hello, everyone. So we've heard some wonderful readings, and of course, we can't add to any of these, but we'll try. Now, Mr. Judge, we heard, suffered tremendously from a disease which was ultimately fatal at a very young age, not quite 45 years. And what a tremendous amount of work he did without trying to draw attention to himself. There's a short saying by Rumi, be a light, be a lifeboat, and be a ladder. And he certainly was all of those. And we would like to add, he was also a lightning rod. Not intentionally, but these ideas are truly revolutionary. When you consider, we take it for granted, Eastern wisdom today, many of us. We've all come in touch with some Eastern wisdom. It has fortunately permeated our society. Maybe not quite enough, but it's you know, there's just so many variations of the light of Asia, which some, you know, some are false teachers, of course, just like there always are false teachers. And but the readings are there. His rendition of the Bhagavad Gita, which we study every summer, in those 18 chapters, is all the philosophy one ever needs to learn. It's all there. He, of course, as was said, he wrote volumes, as did his co-worker and teacher, H.B. Blavatsky, which we have a commemorative day in May to honor our teachers, because if you cannot honor your teachers, you're really not worthy of the teachings of what they have given us. So he was a light, certainly, coming from the East in a sense, but not so much in geographical means, but he was truly the bridge. He was the bridge between the Eastern and Western mind, as was HPB, but Mr. Judge was a native speaker of English and a master of the language and a master of putting his words clearly and succinctly. And it's really very interesting to observe that when we read his writings that were written in the 1880s and 1890s today, they're really fresh. If we go to other authors of the same era, it's kind of almost like we need to translate in our minds as we go along, and it kind of slows us down. But not with Mr. Judge, we should read him every day. Every day we should read a little. one of his writings which stands out, it's a very short article. It's only a page and a half. It's called Advantages and Disadvantages in Life. And we think it should be a primer for anyone who wants to comprehend the nub of karma, because we are many and varied. We come from all walks of life, and we look around and we only remember this one life, unless eventually we can reach a point where we do get knowledge of our former lives. But for the vast majority, all we remember is this one life. And we see maybe our conditions are harsh. Maybe we can't take that Hawaiian vacation that our neighbor is taking. Or we don't drive a BMW. We drive an old Ford, maybe an old Ford F-150 pickup. And we think like, if only I had this or that, or if I was able to travel, if I had artworks that adorn my wall. But Mr. Judge tells us that that's like, those circumstances and conditions are like eating a box full of chocolates. we may love the eating, but it will turn to acid in our stomachs, and we will certainly suffer the consequences. And so when we're born under difficult and harsh conditions, it's actually pleasing to the soul. The soul knows what it needs. And we can be there. We can be a light. We can be a lifeboat. And we can be a ladder. We can help our fellows out of their limiting conditions to look at the big picture. That's what's missing from most of the Western ideas of the past, we'll say 2,000 years, at least certainly since the closing of the schools in Alexandria. So, Mr. Judge, he wasn't known that well to many. He wasn't, the real Mr. Judge was hidden, because there's a saying that the power that the disciple shall covet is to appear as nothing in the eyes of men. So by appearing as nothing, his ideas, he was able to express his ideas. He never wanted people to look up to him. He didn't assume any titles, as any true teacher would never assume any titles or take any titles unto themselves. So, Mr. Judge, had a great way with words. He traveled all over. Well, he traveled. We have to consider too, he was left here in the United States at the age of 27 alone to promulgate the philosophy of theosophy, because it was part of the plan for the other two founders, HPB and Colonel Olcott, to go to India, the land, to resuscitate theosophy in the land where it never really died, but where it had waned. We'll say it had waned. So Mr. Judge is a 27-year-old man, married, with those responsibilities as well, a lawyer, and he kept the light, he kept the lamp lit, he kept the light alive. He went to India in 1884, and when he came back, there was he had flowered, we'll say. The wisdom in him had really come forth, had really blossomed. And so he traveled all over the United States. He did lecture tours. He went to the World Parliament of Religions in 1893. He made his way to San Francisco. And so we wanted to read just one short thing, which is, so we had said earlier that that he really was a lightning rod too, and anyone with ideas that literally upset the apple cart of the whole system, we're talking about religion, philosophy, and science, and that is what theosophy is. It's a marriage of religion, philosophy, and science. It's a unitary philosophy. It's not compartmentalized. In the West, we've become so specialized that we may be studying one bug out of millions, and somehow we can get a grant written, and and we can study that, and then it may very well, you know, do a lot of good. But so Mr. Judge, he suffered not only from without but from within. But his advice to those that are being attacked personally is this: never mind what others do, put no one out of your heart. Go on with the work you see. In time, all of the follies of ignorance of others will fall to nothing. When the time is ripe, we will all have gained strength. When those who have fallen away for a while come back, there we will be with open arms as strong brothers to help them to find the path and smooth out the effects of errors they created through ignorance. So, it's principles above personalities. And that is the beauty of the Theosophical movement at its base, at its core, at its heart. It's impersonal. It's not uncaring. Sometimes we hear impersonal and we think, oh, well, that means they don't care. Nothing could be further from the truth. It's a caring, loving philosophy. Mr. Judge was truly a bridge in that not just the Eastern and Western, but in our higher self, we are spirit, we are heart, and we are mind. And he was heart and mind. He was the rarest of all things, which is a practical mystic. Our view of mystics generally are someone who wanders in the woods and, you know, it may be dropping pearls of wisdom here and there, but that we hope we can pick up. But he was right there. He was available. He was present. Whenever anyone tried to lighten his load, he would gladly assign duties to others, but he would always find something, some new challenge for him to tackle. And when asked about this, because his health was failing, we have to understand, and he was a young man, but he looked many years senior to his actual age. So when he was approached and when he wasn't resting, he would say, my rest is in my work. And that's something to contemplate. If you are truly on a spiritual quest, then you're not really looking for, you're not looking for rest. Time is limited. Each life, we only get a finite amount of time. Yes, we're eternal beings, but we need to make it real. We need to make it pure and true. We need to stretch our hand out in the flesh. The after-death states, which we will be studying, we have been studying, and will be studying on Wednesday nights, are effect states. We can't accomplish anything there. We get our rewards or our punishments, but, and really, when we say punishment, it's just a correction, we should say, because anything we're being punished for is what we've created. Nothing else. So, we think that's about it. We want to stress, too, though, that Mr. Judge was HPB's only friend. Can you imagine the thousands, if not tens of thousands, of people that she came in contact with? And Judge was her only trusted friend, associate, brother. And but what the two of them accomplished will carry through the ages. But it's up to us. It's up to us to keep it going. It's up to us to keep it lit. We have the teachings. We have the teachers. They're working behind the scenes. But we have each other, and love, charity, faith, hope, and charity. The greatest of these is charity, and charity is love. It's unconditional love. So we invite you to spread the love today among each other and spend the last few minutes of the meeting, if you will, just talking with your partner, your neighbor, your friend. And we thank you all for coming here to commemorate this day.